John Clayton.
Powered through the Alaska Airlines Studios.
Streaming live at 710sports.com. On demand everywhere on the 710 Seattle Sports app. Now, John Clayton.
And joining us in the Zeke's Pizza Hotline is Matt Maioka from NBC Sports Bay Area. All right, let's go in retrospect, Matt. When you were starting to figure out this season, what record did you pin to this team? My guess would be you probably didn't think Super Bowl.
I didn't think Super Bowl. I certainly didn't think 13 wins. I did think 9-7, though. And, yeah, I thought that if things fell right, that, you know, they could be in the playoffs. I thought that they were a team that would enter December very much in the playoff hunt. But, you know, I kind of looked at a stretch of games there when they played, you know, the Packers, Ravens, Saints, you know, Seattle a couple times. I kind of looked at that as being the part of the season that would have them fall short. It ended up being the part of the season that defined their season. So, I mean, I knew they'd be better. I didn't know that they would be this good, though.
No, because I thought with the additions on the defensive line and Kwame Alexander and some of the things that they ended up doing, I like you, thought they were going to be the most improved team in football. But to go from 2-14 to the Super Bowl is incredible.
Yeah, and I mean, what you saw, though, was those first 2 years of Shanahan and Lynch, 2017, 2018. They were competitive in a lot of those games. In 2017, they lost their first 9 games of the season. But 5 of those losses in a row were by 3 points or fewer. So they weren't getting blown out. So you knew that, you know, they're going in the right direction, that they had. Even during those losing seasons, they did have a really good thing that they were building. You could feel it. You know, there wasn't a bunch of, you know, there was a turmoil in the locker room. There weren't guys bickering. They all continually expressed confidence and, you know, confidence in the coaching staff and the direction the team was going. So you knew that at some point they were going to turn it around. I just didn't know it'd be this year and this dramatically.
No, exactly. In fact, I mean, you're the one that I think educated me on the one. What was the turnover, the few number of turnovers they had last year?
Yeah, exactly. So, yeah, the entire 16-game season, the 49ers forced 7 turnovers or forced, you know, they had 7 takeaways and 2 interceptions the entire year. And so, yeah, you knew that those numbers would probably triple, if not more, which they did. And a lot of it had to do was, you know, that they did not have an outside pass rush. You know, they had, you know, some good players on that defense, and they had confidence in the defensive backfield. But, you know, they started the season, or they went through the season last year with Cassius Marsh as their best edge rusher. And when you replace Cassius Marsh with Dee Ford and Nick Bosa, well, boom, you know, all of a sudden, you're looking at a dramatic turnaround and a dramatic influx of new talent.
Yeah, no question. And that's where I thought it was, yeah, because, yeah, and I know this it's one of the problems up here. You look at the lack of pass rush with only 28 sacks, and it put more pressure on the cornerbacks. And so how much better did it make the defensive backs with the pressure that Bosa and the rest of the defensive line was able to make?
Oh, I mean, it was night and day. I mean, the players and the defensive backfield did not change. You know, maybe they improved, and in the case of Richard Sherman, got more healthy. But the 49ers looked at this as, you know, we kind of like the guys back there. They stuck with Jaquaski Tartt at safety. They stuck with Jimmy Ward at safety. They stuck with Akello Witherspoon, Richard Sherman, and now Emmanuel Mosley coming back. They did add Jason Verrett, but that was kind of a no risk. You know, if he turns out great, if not, then, you know, no harm done. But where they thought that they could improve all those numbers that we talked about, including the interceptions, was by investing in the pass rush and, you know, getting Nick Bosa in here and getting Dee Ford in here. So that's basically the approach they took, and it proved to be a very wise decision.
No doubt. Talk about, because it's interesting because, you know, they make the trade for Dee Ford, and he's going to be one of the most interesting guys in the Super Bowl because he comes from Kansas City. It was a second-round pick. You know he's bitter about it. But his playing time really wasn't much this year, although he played well in the times he was out there. What did he have, like 22% play time?
Yeah, I mean, he was injured, you know, for a lot of the year. He kind of started off in training camp. He was battling knee tendonitis. And then about, you know, midway through the year, he developed a hamstring issue. In the final six games of the regular season, he was on the field for a total of four snaps. So the numbers are just very dramatic when Dee Ford was out there as opposed to when Dee Ford wasn't out there. And with that speed on the edge, I mean, he creates more space for the inside guys to operate. He's a dynamic pass rusher. He helps everybody on that defensive line be better. And so, you know, the focus late in the year was make sure he's healthy for the playoffs, and he's been healthy. And I think the game on Sunday against the Packers was the most he's played this entire season. And, I mean, they're expecting him to be a big factor on Super Bowl Sunday.
Oh, yeah, no doubt. And that's going to be a fascinating part of it. Talk about you know, the Shanahan run game, because you know, I think it's safe to say that he's the best run calling play caller in football with the very things that he's been able to do, which, of course, is a second generation thing that comes from his father.
Yeah, I mean, it certainly reminds me of Mike Shanahan and how they were able to, when he was with the Denver Broncos, you know, basically every year it seemed like there was somebody else, you know, obviously Terrell Davis at the beginning, but, you know, every year there was, you know, Landis Gary or what, Mike Anderson, and, you know, some of the other names that put together big seasons. And it's a, you know, the outside zone, you know, they none of the offensive linemen, well, I shouldn't say none of the offensive linemen, certainly Joe Staley and Mike McGlinchey, first-round draft picks, but, you know, they've kind of pieced it together on the inside, found some pieces that work, and it's really become quite a formidable group where, you know, we saw different running backs pretty much every week, whether it's Matt Breida or Tevin Coleman or Raheem Mostert. Well, right now, Raheem Mostert is the hot hand. And when they find something that works and the defense doesn't make the adjustments, they're going to stick with it, as they did on Sunday, you know, running for 285 yards against the Green Bay Packers. And the dilemma, I think, for defenses is, okay, once you start making those adjustments to try to take the run away, then they can hit you with the passing game. And the Packers never made those adjustments. And so Kyle Shanahan said, all right, well, we'll just continue to stick with the run. And as a result, Jimmy Garoppolo doesn't have to ice his arm or take a shower or anything after the game because he was only used on eight passing plays.
How do you kind of size up this game against Kansas City? Because obviously one of the keys, and you saw it in the New Orleans game, is that Jimmy Garoppolo and the 49ers, if necessary, can get into a high-scoring type of game. But wouldn't you anticipate that this could be high-scoring because of Patrick Mahomes?
Yeah, it's really difficult to gauge that. I would think so, and I would think that's probably a little bit more inspiration or motivation for the 49ers to try to get that run game going and chew up the clock, control the game as far as the time of possession. You know, you want to keep Patrick Mahomes off the field. I think that's safe to say. But, yeah, the 49ers have shown that they can win games in all kinds of different ways, whether it's the grinded-out running attack or whether they're throwing the ball around the field and having to roll up 48 points on the New Orleans Saints like they did in that 48-46 victory. So Garoppolo has played some really good games in hostile environments. I don't think there's any question here that he has what it takes to be a Super Bowl winning quarterback. But I think as with Jimmy Garoppolo and Patrick Mahomes, it's going to take, you know, to me, those guys, you know, they have what it takes. It's probably going to fall on the guys around them to be the supporting cast that a quarterback needs, and also the defense on the other side of the ball.
Matt Maiocco, great stuff, and looking forward to seeing you in down in Miami, where it's going to be a little bit warmer than it is here in Seattle, and looking forward to that. Matt Maiocco from NBC Bay Area Sports joining us on the Zeke's Pizza Hotline. Thank you, sir.
All right, John. My pleasure. I'll see you in Miami.
Okay, sounds good. And, of course, you can listen to the show via the 710 Sports app. It's powered by the Dubin Law Group. Coming up next, we get the report card. It's the John Clayton Show, 710 ESPN Seattle.
It's time for the Report Card with the Professor.
In the Report Card, we get out every day. We look at the good, the bad, the ugly, the smart, the stupid, what people say, what people do. We'll take the stories, the anecdotes. We'll take the social media implications. We'll take the voices, all those different things, and attach a grade. And helping us out is Boy Howdy. And so, Boy Howdy, I guess you can say that you know, in Green Bay, they made the announcement today as far as Mike Pettine. They didn't make any change, but they asked the new coach, Matt LaFleur, about is there going to be any change at defensive coordinator. He says, well, we're still trying to investigate and look at a lot of things this offseason, which, of course, tells you they're thinking about firing Mike Pettine for not adjusting to San Francisco. How do you kind of grade that for almost selling out the coach?
Yeah, I'm not a huge fan of that. But then again, if it's true, if that's really what they're doing and they feel like Mike Pettine was holding them back, then they should move on. They should fail that guy out and get somebody that they trust. So in that sense, I have a hard time giving him a terrible grade for it. That said, you probably shouldn't go to the media before you know exactly what you're going to do. And that's a bad look. So in that sense, it probably is a bad grade.
Yeah, and that's where it's like, okay, because when you say that, then, I mean, you know that even if he keeps his job, and of course, you know, Pettine was a holdover from the Mike McCarthy staff, that it's like, okay, well, we did this, and he just didn't adjust in one game. He did a good job all year round, but again, it's like, boy, you kind of point the finger. And we've seen more of that this offseason, I think, as far as, you know, first, second, third-year coaches that are selling out their assistants because things didn't work out well during the season.
It's an interesting development, John. And part of me wonders whether that's sort of playing to the modern athlete who feels like they get held responsible for everything, but nobody holds coaches responsible. So I'm curious. I'm curious to see if these coaches are thick enough, have thick enough skin to handle it.
Yeah, we'll see. But, of course, let us go with the report card.
Let's start with Seahawks defensive tackle Jaron Reed, who's set to become a free agent for the first time in his career. Yesterday on Twitter, Reed responded to a $10 million salary projection for him by saying, quote, "That's disrespectfully low." How are we grading Jared Reed thinking that $10 million is not going to be enough for him come free agency?
Well, I'm a little biased on this one because I'm the one that's been putting out the $8 to $10 million figure. And so I'm going to give it a C because honestly, I don't know exactly where the value is. I know that Boy Howdy did a great job of working up some top 100 things that I'm still going over right now and attaching numbers and stuff like that. And, you know, different. He's projected to be like the 59th best free agent, but that doesn't put him over the $10 million a year mark. I mean, if you look at the way it goes in unrestricted free agency. So, yeah, I'm going to give it a C because I'm just going to be neutral on this to think which way it's going to go. But, you know, we had to if it was negotiating after last year with 10 and a half sacks, then you're talking 14 to 15 million. This year without the sacks and missing six games, it's going to be a little bit lower. And he's a good player. There's no question about it. But I still get the feeling that when you read a tweet like that, he's thinking he's out of here.
Yeah, that's great analysis, John, and I agree with you. I would assume that coming off of a lower year, and to be frank, even without the sack numbers, the Seahawks defensive line with Jadeveon Clowney and Jaron Reed was not disruptive in any facet of the game, whether it was running or passing. So if it were up to me, I'm not going to spend more than $7 or $8 million on Jaron Reed because I didn't see enough that would say the Seahawks defense with paying $21 million to Jadeveon Clowney and then another 9 or 10 to Jaron Reed. I'm spending $30 million on those two guys to have the same defense come back next year. I don't know. I don't really love that idea, that perspective. So I'm going to give him an A for his perspective. If he can get more than that, I'm so happy for him. I hope he does it. But for the Seahawks, I don't think they really need him, especially at a high rate. So from a Seahawks perspective, I'm going to give this a C-.
Next on today's report card, Derek Jeter got elected to the Baseball Hall of Fame yesterday. 99.7% of the vote he received, which means he was one vote away from unanimous induction. How are we grading Derek Jeter falling one vote short of everybody naming him on his ballot?
Well, it's funny because, I mean, you listen to talk shows locally, nationally, and all that stuff. I mean, there's two ways you look at it. It's like, okay, I look at it as a big deal because I take this stuff seriously, and I think that Derek Jeter should have been a unanimous one. And in baseball, of course, I mean, you're not in a meeting like we are where we're voting and we're talking each other up and all those different things. I mean, you're just kind of it's by proxy, and it's like, okay, if you're a little vindictive, you just say, I'm not going to put him in just to make it different. So I'm going to give that an F. But then the other tact is like, it's not that big of a deal. Well, I think it is a big deal. You take this stuff seriously. You knew he was a Hall of Famer, but you know, why hold it against Ken Griffey Jr. and also now Derek Jeter to miss a vote or two and not have it unanimous?
Yeah, you know, I like that perspective, John. I'm a little different of mind in this because I think that it was one of the greatest embarrassments of baseball's Hall of Fame that the first and only unanimous member is a reliever. And reliever wasn't even a position in baseball when they created the game. But they're going to make that the first person who was a unanimous selection. I think that that's an embarrassment. And to say that Derek Jeter doesn't get to be there, he's not the greatest shortstop that ever lived. Was he the greatest leader on an era of baseball teams that was probably the greatest era of baseball in the 90s Yankees? Yeah, he was, but that doesn't mean that he is by far and away the best player in baseball history. And I think it's a shame that the best players in baseball history, there's probably 100 guys. I mean, every person who was a first ballot Hall of Famer is an undoubted Hall of Famer. So the fact that there's a little distinction to make sure that we don't remember Derek Jeter as the greatest shortstop of all time, which I don't think he is, I'm kind of okay with that. I'm glad that he didn't get the 100% because he's not the greatest of all time. So I'm actually going to give this whole story an A.
Wow, bold take there from Howdy. Also, on the report card, Major League Baseball, they plan on using robot umps to call balls and strikes during spring training games this season. Rob Manfred announced those plans Wednesday during an interview with the Fox Business Network, saying that the camera-based system will be more accurate than a human being standing there. He also added, "We believe over the long haul, it's going to be more accurate. It will reduce controversy in the game and be good for the game." I know Mariners insider Shane Andrade very much not in favor of robot umpires, but it looks like they are coming and getting here very quickly. How are we grading Major League Baseball's slow rollout of robot umpires?
I'm going to give it a D because, remember, there's a union involved in this, and the union's the baseball umpires and officials and all that, and I think they're going to have a major protest with this. And I would not be surprised. I don't know where they are as far as collective bargaining, but I would have to think that there could be a walkout or something of that nature if they do that, because you're putting officials in a position where, okay, you got to cooperate with people, machines are going to put you out of work at some point. So I'm going to give it I'm going to go with Shannon on this one.
Yeah, you know, I'm kind of a different mind because I think what Rob Manfred said is right. It is going to be more accurate, and it is going to cut down on some controversy. I mean, look at what happened in tennis. In tennis, it used to be a judgment call. Now they use an electronic system, and balls in play and out of play is not an issue anymore. So in that sense, yes, it will eliminate that problem. But that's not really the spirit of baseball. That's not really what baseball's always been about, the absolute factual correctness of balls and strikes. That's always been sort of an artistic element of the game, a pitcher pitching a pitch, a specific spot, to hopefully work that way so that by the fifth or sixth inning, he can get that call that's just a little bit off because he's put in all the work during that game to be able to earn that call. So in that sense, I don't like the idea of robot umpires, but I think Rob Manfred's absolutely correct. It will cut down on that problem. And if they are going to eventually move to this anyways and there is no stopping it, then let's go. Let's start doing it now. Putting it in place in spring training is the best proving ground. It'll get the most people exposed to it. We'll get used to it. And then we can move on and just forget that this was really ever a controversy in baseball, in my opinion.
Lastly, on the report card, Kansas and Kansas State basketball, pretty heated rivalry in the Midwest. Well, it came to blows last night after a Kansas State player went up for a layup late in the game. He was blocked by a Kansas player, and then the Jayhawk then proceeded to taunt him. Players from both teams ran off the bench to separate the two, and then fists were flying to the point where Silvio D'Souza, forward for the Jayhawks, picked up a stool and was about to swing it at players. Here's the call from ESPN's broadcast.
And a block to finish. And D'Souza blocks it, and now the bench is empty. Just unnecessary.
Yeah. That's not good.
This is a punch call. This is bad.
No.
No good. Oh, this is terrible.
There are going to be ramifications for this going forward.
And it's just no point to it.
How are we grading the Jayhawks and Wildcats going at it in a pretty heated fashion?
Yeah, I think it's horrible. I'm going to give it an F because, again, you should have to have control. I know that it's going to be physical sometimes. In basketball, you're going to do it. When you get to the point where it's like, okay, you have the fisticuffs going and you're starting to lift chairs, that's an F. Totally out of control, inexcusable.
I agree with you. It is an F. Although I will say I really love fights in baseball and hockey, so I love to see those, but never at the amateur level. I only like to see it at the pro level because I don't want to see any of these college kids have some sort of a stigma attached to them as they try to start their professional career. They haven't made a dime for what they've done so far, and if this can negatively impact them, I think that's terrible. So this is an F for this whole situation, and I feel sorry for everyone that it happened.
Yep, it is. Not good stuff. Hey, by the way, our playoff coverage is brought to you by Washington Farm Bureau Healthcare. Coming up next, we are taking your text questions at 710-710. John Clayton Show, 710 ESPN Seattle.
John Clayton.
Powered through the Alaska Airlines Studios.
On demand with the 710 Seattle Sports app.
Well, it is now time to take your text questions. Text us at 710-710. And Curtis, what do we got?
From the 206, John, they heard us talking about that Kansas-Kansas State brawl in the last segment. They want to know, what is the craziest brawl either one of us have been in attendance for?
Well, I still remember, this goes back a long way, Bruce Keeson was a pitcher for the Pirates, and Mike Schmidt, of course, being the great third baseman for the Philadelphia Phillies. And so, Keeson loved to throw inside and try to get the guy off home plate and all that stuff. And so he hit Mike Schmidt, and Mike Schmidt then takes his bat, points it out to the pitcher's mound to Bruce Keeson, and says, "Next time I'm going to come get you." And then Bruce Keeson says, "Why don't you make next time this time?" And so Mike Schmidt then runs out to the mound, starts swinging. He ends up breaking, I think, one of his fingers in the punch and all that stuff. Then the bench is just unloaded. And it was just, to have that kind of, confrontation and all that stuff, why don't you make next time this time? But it was a pretty good battle.
I like that. The craziest brawl I have ever been in attendance for was 2011, my sophomore year at Arizona. They were playing UCLA, and the video of it is crazy because it starts off with a fan dressing up as a fake referee running on the field, blowing a play dead. The referees are standing around like, "Who's this guy? We don't know who this guy is." He then proceeds to strip his clothes off, run around on one side of the field, and then on the other side of the field, a brawl breaks out between UCLA and Arizona. It was the last game before UCLA announced they were going to be moving on from Rick Neuheisel as their head coach. I think Nick Foles was Arizona's quarterback. It was insanity. It took about 10-15 minutes for the benches to regain control. If you have a chance, check it out. I'll tweet out the video of it on my Twitter account, at a kid from Kent. But it is one of the craziest videos you'll see. From the 509, John, what are your expectations for the XFL in year one?
I think good. I mean, I know that they got the final roster cut today, so they got the 52-man roster all set. I think that what I'm looking forward to is just seeing the fast-paced nature of it. Again, we watched last year with the AAF. Again, they didn't have good quarterbacks. This league, the XFL, has better quarterbacks. Not great, but still better quarterbacks. I think it can be fun because, again, it's continued football. And it's like football that's going to be on every game is going to be televised. So I think the expectations are good. And what you like is Vince McMahon has a deeper pocket right now than the AAF. And so I think it can be all right.
From the, let's see here, from the 360, they want to know, John, what do you expect Austin Hooper's market to be?
I think 9 to 10 million. I mean, right now, and it could go higher than that. I mean, Jimmy Graham's the standard right now at 10, and some of the other tight end deals have been coming in between 8 and 10. So I think that, if you're going to be Atlanta, I mean, you hope to get him for a little bit under 10, but if not, he gets in the free agency, I think he can get above 10.
360 wants to know, John, do you see the Raiders making enough moves this offseason to put them in the playoffs?
I could see it because, again, it's like I still think it's a watered-down AFC. I mean, to a point where, I mean, here's a 7-9 Raider team that was still in the playoff hunt in the last week of the season. And, I don't know how many teams are going to improve or how many teams are going to drop back in the AFC, but it's the margin's all there. I mean, you watch Buffalo get in. Tennessee was able to come back from 2-4 and get in. And so, you know, Pittsburgh may be back in the mix next year with Ben Roethlisberger back. You know, Baltimore is going to be solid, Kansas City solid. But no, I think they have a chance.
From the 360, they want to know, with Chris Carson and Rashad Penny coming back from injuries, do you anticipate the Seahawks looking to draft a running back or maybe getting one in free agency?
I think that they might want a little experience because they've got the young back and Travis Homer. They'll have to do something because the number is going to be down because, you know, Penny's not going to be a participant, I'm sure, in training camp because he's coming off the ACL. I know that there seems to be hope that Chris Carson might be able to do something, you know, I don't know, in the OTAs or maybe at minicamp or something like that. But, no, I think they have to add something. So I think more a veteran experienced guy, but it doesn't have to be necessarily a great guy.
With the possibility of Justin Britt and the Seahawks moving on from each other, the 425 wants to know, will the center position be high on the Seahawks draft priority list?
I don't think so. I think more it would be more tackle than it would be because particularly, you know, if they, you know, they have two tackles that are up and you would think they have a better chance of getting George Fant done than they do their former first round pick in Jermaine Ifedi. So I think tackle right now is a little bit more important than, the center position. But again, it's like, you know, right now you got a center's coming off an ACL and Joey Hunt, who is, you know, a little not the biggest guy, did a good job, but he's more of a backup.
360 wants to know, is the cliche defense wins championships still true in the modern NFL?
That's not true. That's so old right now. And the reason I say it's not true is that, you know, you can look and see it's still quarterbacks that win championships and hot quarterbacks. Because, again, you look at the AFC and you go back to 2003. I mean, there's only now five quarterbacks that have won championships, either, you know, going to the Super Bowl or winning the Super Bowl. And that, of course, was Tom Brady. It was Peyton Manning. It was Joe Flacco. And, now, of course, you add Patrick Mahomes in the mix. And then, of course, it's in Ben Roethlisberger. Those are the four. And now the new one is Patrick Mahomes. So, no, it's quarterbacks that win championships and Super Bowls, not defense.
From the 253, they say, Mr. Clayton, do you think the sign-stealing fiasco in baseball is just the tip of the iceberg? Will more information come out with a tell-all like Jose Canseco did during the steroid era?
Probably is going to be because, again, I mean, you have whistleblowers and you have people that can actually, you know, write some books and get some popularity out of that. And I think that, these tales, particularly, you hear the story about the buzzers that were certainly in Altuve's that was, you know, now posted by a pitcher and all that stuff. No, I think more stuff is going to come out like that.
The 425 wants to know, John, is there any possibility Ohio State's Chase Young falls beyond Washington at number two?
No way. No. And I think particularly when you see, you know, with what Nick Bosa has done for San Francisco, and there's a school of thought, I don't know if I agree with it or not, but it is possible that, he's better than Bosa. I think both are great right now. And so if you're sitting with the number two pick in the draft, you take Young.
Yeah, you look at the Ohio State defensive ends that have come out over the last 4 or 5 years. Joey Bosa, Nick Bosa, now Chase Young. They're doing something right in Columbus with their defensive ends. From the 253, they want to know, how do you anticipate Jimmy Garoppolo playing in his first ever Super Bowl?
I think he's going to be a little bit nervous. I think they'll put some pressure on him that could cause some problems. But I think he's going to do all right. I just don't think he's going to be the equal of Patrick Mahomes.
541 wants to know, John, do you ever see the Pro Bowl moving back to Hawaii?
Only if Hawaii contributes. And right now I don't see Hawaii contributing enough that's going to make it happening. And again, it's great for the players. It's not necessarily great for the league. It's certainly great for Hawaii if you're able to do it. And, of course, I'd rather, if I was going to the Pro Bowl, I think I'd rather go to Hawaii than Orlando, even though Orlando's the happiest place in the continent.
That's what they say on the entrance gate there. From the 253, they want to know, will Seattle ever get to host a Super Bowl?
I think it's a long shot. I mean, I think that, I mean, when you look at the way that they give northern type of, and this is obviously in the north, when they give northern type of Super Bowls, it usually happens like once or twice every 10 years, and usually it's attached to new stadiums and all that stuff. And you see Minnesota, they got one, and you know at some point Washington's going to try to get a new stadium, and they'll get one. That'll be considered a northern Super Bowl. I'd say right now, I mean, the chances are maybe 20%, but I know that the council's working on it and trying to get something done.
I'd be all for that if it does ever come to Seattle. They'd have to, I believe another sticking point is the amount of hotel rooms.
No, they're okay on the hotel rooms. That's not a problem.
All right.
They've got enough.
Good to know. Good to know. John, that is it for text questions today. We got the Grouse standing by.
Okay. And, of course, he's in studio today. How about that?
Yeah, he is.
How about that? And, of course, be sure to check out the professor's notes on 710sports.com. The professor's notes are brought to you by Infinity of Tacoma at Fife. Coming up next, it's the Grouse.
You're listening to the Professor, John Clayton.
Live from the Alaska Airlines Studios.
Streaming through the 710 Sports app and on 710sports.com.
And joining us with our daily dose of the Groz is Dave Grosby in studio. And, of course, good to be with you again. And, of course, I don't know, did you get to watch the battling basketball fights last night?
I watched, like everyone else did. I wasn't watching Kansas and Kansas State play, which wasn't much of a game, no. But... you can't miss the highlights afterwards. It's all everyone's talking about today. That was quite the brawl.
Yeah, I mean, what's the biggest brawls you've seen through your career?
Oh, man. Tons on TV. Mm-hmm. I'm trying to think of ones I've been at. I think the ones that I think of in the past was obviously the Ron Artest one. I mean, the Malice in the Palace. I mean, that stands out. And I think, John, you remember, you know, in our day, I mean, it was much more commonplace. In fact, often bring up the story of the Phoenix Suns-Boston Celtics NBA Championship Series. I think it was in 75 when they had that great sixth game and Garfield Hurd hit a shot that sent him to double overtime. The fans stormed the court, and you wound up seeing one of the referees, Richie Powers, had a fan in a headlock and was punching him away like it was the WWF. And they just cleared the floor and played. I mean, it's a much different thing when it happens nowadays.
Yeah. But, of course, I mean, that does happen. I mean, you have all the anger and stuff like that, and I don't know if you can police it, stop it, or whatever. But, boy, now, what do you think ramifications of that are going to be?
Well, I think there's already been one announcement that the guy who's the focal point of it, which I'm not sure why he is, DeSouza, is suspended indefinitely at this point and probably be suspended for the rest of the year. I think there's plenty of blame to go around here. You know, this is one where the coaches are going to have to look at themselves. I mean, they're kind of responsible for keeping guys on the bench. This escalated because guys left the bench. I understand it's very difficult to control them when you have a circumstance like you had in that game, but there'll be ramifications there as well for coaches. I would imagine fines, things like that, suspensions. I mean, it's, if you look at the video, it's hard to pinpoint any one thing. I'd like to know who the guy in the black shirt was, though. You watched the video a few times, right?
I've not seen the video, no.
Okay, well, you have to watch the video a few times. We can talk about it tomorrow, because there's a fan, I'm going to call him, in a black shirt who got involved, who punched a player, which really escalated the thing. So I'd like to know who that was.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, but it gets out of control, and you got to wonder. I mean,
well, let me say this, John. Yeah. I don't view this as a big problem. This is not something that's epidemic in college basketball. I mean, you don't have stories like this happening all the time. So I don't think this is something that they need to get together. We got a problem here. This has been escalated. You know, this strikes me as the dictionary definition of an isolated incident.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, because again, it doesn't happen that often, but it does happen, and that's where I guess, and because it's so spontaneous, it's really hard to say, okay, what can we do to fix this up or prevent it from happening?
Right, exactly.
You can't prevent it from happening.
I mean, I'm hard pressed, John, sitting here talking to you, to think of the last time anything like this happened in college basketball. I might say that I don't know that I don't think I've ever seen it happen before in college basketball to the level that it was yesterday. You know, you've had little altercations, but nothing like yesterday. So it's not. It sounds weird to say. But this is not a problem. Mm-hmm. This is not a problem. Now, maybe, you know, issues about unwritten rules, because that's kind of what started the whole thing, was the guy, you know, down 22 points and stealing the ball, going in for a layup, and the Kansas guy stole it from, you know, blocking the shot dramatically. You know, that may have started a little beef, but it shouldn't have started this whole thing. So I don't think there's any great need to get people together to solve an issue that's not really an issue.
No, that's true, and of course it's.
But you got to see the video, man.
Yeah, yeah. Of course, I had the interesting day today because I had to renew my global entry, so I had to go down to the customs office and meet the good people. The good part is the person that took me in, the officer, was actually listening to me at 7:15 this morning, saying I was coming into TSA to get my
nice
update. Because again, what happened? I don't know. Do you have pre-check?
I've had it, yes.
Yeah. And, of course, I mean, what it comes down to is that there's a certain, I guess, percentage, and I was part of the small percentage, that doesn't automatically renew.
Oh,
and of
course, no, so mine is always renewed.
Well, I had to go in for my, and it's basically, and it's really.
It's an easy thing. I've done it.
Yeah. Well, of course, the easy thing is doing it. The tough thing is scheduling it.
Right.
And literally, I had to schedule this in September, and this was the first day, January 22nd, where I could go in and do that. And, of course, one of the things they do is they retake your fingerprints, they take your eye profile and all that stuff, and so that does, I think, help, and it updates everything, which is good.
So it took away your prep time this morning is what you're telling me.
Well, that, no, honestly, it's like my appointment was scheduled for 8:30. Okay, so I got to the airport at about 6:20 because, you know, I had to make sure I had some spot where I can do the 7:15 hit, and I had a hit in St. Louis, and so I had to do that and then wait for the office to open up at 8. Well, I got out of there literally because the gentleman was nice enough to, you know, get me. We had two people there, and so they moved me in there at about 8:15, and I got done into the car by 8:39. Problem was, coming up 4:05. It took me 90 minutes almost to get back. I mean, I barely made the start of the show.
I tell you, man, walking is the thing if you can do it.
Yeah. But
commuting is for the birds these days.
I agree with that. I mean, I can walk to the Seahawks. That's
I know what you mean, but you can't walk everywhere all the time.
No, can't do it. Can't do it. All right, so getting interesting on the baseball front right now because, I mean, you can see baseball signings and all that, and we're getting closer now to spring training. And
yeah, we are about a month away.
Yeah, agreed. And I know that Mariners have their spring training preview.
I believe it's tomorrow.
Oh, it's tomorrow?
Yeah, tomorrow morning.
Oh, okay. I guess we're not doing the show from down there because I haven't been told, so I guess not.
I think we just heard about it just a day or two ago. Yeah, it's tomorrow from 10:30 to noon. So yeah, we'll have our guys down there talking about it, and it's still a month out, but pitchers and catchers are getting ready to report, and hopefully that'll be more of the story. We'll be playing, and congratulations to Derek Jeter. And Larry Walker for getting into the Hall of Fame.
But I'll tell you the one thing that's also interesting about the voting, and of course I'm sensitive to this because I've now been a Pro Football Hall of Fame voter for 30 years, is that the outrage, as I think there should be, for no unanimous for Derek Jeter, no unanimous for Ken Griffey Jr. You know, one person did not vote for Derek Jeter, and I think that's wrong.
Three didn't vote for Griffey. I mean, to me, it's typical baseball that the guy who is in there is the ultimate specialist. The only guy who got 100% of the vote is the guy who you can argue in terms of innings pitched and impact. You know, had a great impact at the end of games, but wasn't a starting pitcher, wasn't an everyday player. It's 27 people didn't vote for Willie Mays his first time in, John. I mean, that's 15 didn't vote for Hank Aaron. So it's ridiculous. It's absolutely ridiculous. It's another one of those things where they shouldn't publicize the vote.
Mm-hmm.
They just shouldn't do it. There's no point in doing it. Announce who wins. Don't announce how much guys miss by. But anyway, Jeter gets in. He handled it the way he should have. Jeter was, a great player, not as great as people think, but certainly a very impactful player.
Yeah, but of course, I mean,
he's not the best shortstop to ever play the game, not by a long shot.
No, but that's the thing. I mean, it's not the best of the best. I mean, it's going to be, I mean, you're going in there because if you're worthy to be in the Hall of Fame, what did you feel now? I guess, only two getting in this year.
Right.
I like the fact that we are always catching up and have five in the Pro Football Hall of Fame.
Much smarter.
Yeah, again, because, again, you want to take care of those people. How long do you think it's going to take or ever that you're going to see Barry Bonds and some of the guys from the steroid era making it?
Well, let's talk about Bonds and he stayed about the same, and Clemens about 60%. So they're at the 8-year point, I think, I want to say. So they've got a few more years to go. It's older voters that are keeping them out. I don't know to answer you how long that'll go. I mean, older people tend to be a little more inflexible and unwilling to change. So I'm not certain that they will be getting in, John.
Yeah, no, I would agree
with
you.
They're closer, but what I think from an ex-Mariner standpoint, although he wasn't here for his whole career, it was a very encouraging showing for one Omar Vizquel, who almost doubled his total, I think, from 26% to 52%, and he's got a shot to make a late run at this thing, and he makes it on some defensive metrics. So it'd be nice to see him get in.
Yeah, it really would be, because again, but it's funny because there's more, I guess, openness to a certain degree in the baseball voting. Of course, more of the baseball voters put out their ballots that you can see and you can judge and you can criticize.
Yeah, and what's the point of that?
Yeah.
I mean, you know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
I'm not sure. You don't do that in football.
Nope, we don't.
You announce who goes in, and they go in, and those who don't go in don't go in. And don't tell me it's about publicity and more talking about it. It baseball is transparent in ways it doesn't need to be.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we can have a long discussion one day on my opinion of this whole scandal and the way they're handling it. I think it's just crazy. But baseball's transparent when they don't need to be and when it doesn't serve their purpose.
Yeah,
how about that?
That's part of the reality of baseball, and go where that one goes. And of course, now are you doing a show today?
Nope, just happened to be in.
Wow, how about that? Well, thank you for dropping by.
Of course, John.
Because that was our daily dose of the Groz. And of course, we will be back tomorrow at 10. It's the John Clayton Show, 710 ESPN Seattle.